Welcome to Hannah's Heart.
So Hannah, she's just one of the women who did struggle with infertility in the Bible.
No matter who we are, we can be inspired by the fact that Hannah took her pain to God and God heard her and was with her.
So when she was praying at the temple, she had been weeping and not eating, and her lips were moving, but her eyes were closed, and the priest was like, why are you drunk at the temple?
Yeah. It can become an obsession when you want a child so deeply.
And desiring that baby and to be a mama. Every holiday, every Mother's Day.
This is not a show that's going to promise you a certain outcome. But this is a show that says, however God answers your cry, we know that He's enough.
Hi, I'm Kendra.
And I'm Anne. And you are listening today to Hannah's Heart on American Family Radio. We are a radio show slash podcast that focuses a lot on infertility and miscarriage, but we have covered adoption and foster care and child loss. And today we're covering a new subject with the same guest that we've had on before. And so we are just, I feel like growing and growing with each topic that we end up covering. But you can always send us more topics and prayer requests at hannahsheart@afa.net. That's hannahsheart@afa.net.
Yeah, so if you've listened to us at all on any of AFA's, AFR's other programs recently, Ann and I have been talking a lot about the recent Alabama ruling, and there's been a lot of questions about Christians and IVF, and should Christians do IVF? So we decided to have back on someone who I am very close to and very proud to know. He was the doctor that helped us to get our precious little girl, Eliana, and his name is Dr. Gordon from Rejoice Fertility. So Dr. Gordon, welcome back on to the show.
No, thanks so much. It's a pleasure to be here with y'all.
For those who missed the last time you were on the show, you talked a lot about the process of IVF and how it's changed over the years, and really helping Christians, I think, to break down and understand the nuance of how can Christians pursue fertility treatments that are life-affirming. And I am so grateful, not just because of having my little daughter, but I have we've had a lot of people reach out to us at Hannah's Heart and ask for more information. And it's so helpful to point people to, of course, your all's clinic is a non-discard facility, meaning you never dispose of any embryos that are created in the image of God. And so we absolutely love that about you. You're the only clinic that I know that does that. There might be more, but I have not encountered them. But first of all, I'd love for you to just tell me what your role is at Rejoice Fertility and why you're passionate about your work.
Right. That's a great question. So I am the owner and the medical director here at Rejoice Fertility. I came here to Knoxville 5 years ago, having practiced in Washington, D.C. for 20 years, and basically became more and more convinced that with some prodding from my wife, who said, I think you're practicing in the wrong way, you need to make a change to do something very different. And that's where we find ourselves. And so we practice very different from pretty much everywhere else in the country. I mean, I don't know if y'all are fans of The Chosen.
Yes.
The opening, the little fish that starts swimming the opposite way. We're the fish swimming the opposite way.
I love that.
So, you know, everyone's going right, we're going left.
And good for y'all.
And that is where we find ourselves. And so, you know, the first thing was the idea of being a no-discard facility, that every embryo deserves a chance. And the only embryo that cannot make a baby is the embryo that you don't transfer. And that's an important part because that guides us in terms of when we talk to patients about IVF, in terms of limiting how many eggs we want to fertilize. Around the country, we don't really know how many embryos are frozen. The number could be as high as 5 million frozen embryos in this country. And yes, and the majority are being held, you know, were created not by faithful Christians or from other religious traditions, but from people who are may have some marginal idea of faith, but they just didn't really think about what they were doing. And then once they've created these embryos, they are sort of stuck. They realize the embryos are special. They don't want to throw them out, but they don't want to use them. They don't know what to do with them. And and this is a huge ongoing problem in the country as people create more and more embryos. And so we wanted to be swimming against that current and really limit how many embryos we create so that we didn't create this problem for our patients where they were stuck with embryos they really had no desire to use but didn't want to throw out or felt that they couldn't throw out. So that was a big part of it. The other thing is that my clinic in D.C. had gone to 100% PGT testing paradigm, where basically all embryos were genetically tested. And I became more and more concerned on several fronts. I mean, one was even, you know, just the scientific perspective. How do we know what we're testing for? How do we know we can trust the results? Does the testing itself, which is invasive, damage the embryo? So an embryo that could have made a baby, by you doing the testing to make sure it's going to make a baby, now it wasn't going to make a baby anymore. And I think that plus the potential that the embryos that we think are abnormal actually turned out to be normal and were discarded based upon that, it becomes more and more problematic. And I felt that really there was just no way to resolve this except to not even offer it. And that's so I went from a 100% genetic testing paradigm to a 0% genetic testing paradigm. That's a pretty large shift.
There is so much to unpack in what you said. And I think a lot of people aren't even familiar with a lot of the terms that you did. So let's kind of back up. You talked about PGT testing. What is that and how, like, why was it initially created?
Sure. So when we go through IVF, you know, the first thing we do is we do an egg collection. So we pull out these eggs from the woman's ovary while she's asleep in the office, and then the egg and the sperm get together, either by putting 100,000 sperm with each egg or by injecting a single sperm into the egg. That's called ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection. Then the next day, we see if the egg is fertilized by the fact that there's two pronuclei, one from the egg and one from the sperm, and so that's a normally fertilized egg. If you see three pronuclei, that's an abnormally fertilized egg, and we can't use it. If we see one pronuclei or no pronuclei, that may or may not be an egg that we could use. Well, then the next day, the egg is divided once, so now it's usually it's 2 to 4 cells, and then the day after that, it's 6 to 8 cells. Now, each one of those cells could make a baby. So if you were to split that 8-cell embryo into 2 4-cell embryos, you would have identical twins.
And that happens sometimes naturally, right?
It does happen. That's exactly right. And we know that does happen now. Most of the splitting goes on a little bit later, but as it becomes later, so day 4, the embryo has about 40 to 50 cells, and it's a solid ball of cells. And then by day 5 or 6, it has become a hollow ball of cells called a blastocyst. So in the blastocyst under the microscope, we can identify 2 distinct population of cells. We have a group of 15 to 30 cells that make up the embryo. That's called the inner cell mass. The rest of the cells form what will become the placenta, and that's called the trophectoderm. Okay. So the question that has plagued genetic testing is, how do you know what your testing represents what the baby will be? Okay. So initially, the genetic testing was conducted when the embryo was 6 to 8 cells. But the problem was if you yanked one of those 6 to 8 cells out of the embryo, it definitely hurt the embryo. And we knew that implantation rates were much lower. And that genetic testing was originally done to screen for cystic fibrosis, where a couple were carriers of cystic fibrosis, and they wanted to avoid having a child with cystic fibrosis. So they did genetic testing of the 8-cell embryo, pulling one of the 8 cells out and making sure that that embryo didn't have cystic fibrosis. But that made a big assumption. That assumed that the one cell you pulled out of the 8 was representative of the other 7. Okay, but that's not necessarily true. So even at that point, there were some early misdiagnoses where they turns out that of the 8 cells, they're not all identical. And they pulled out a cell that said, oh, this embryo is normal. It doesn't have cystic fibrosis. But that was the only normal cell out of the 8. And the others did have cystic fibrosis, and that baby went on to have cystic fibrosis, resulting, as you know, with a lawsuit, of course, because that's the way things are in the United States.
Yeah.
So this concept, then, of the fact that the embryo is made up of different populations of cells that have different jobs and have different blueprints, because what you're really looking at with the genetic testing is what is the blueprint of that embryo? Okay, in other words, you know, what does that baby become? You know, does the baby have a normal number of chromosomes, like, you know, for you women, 46XX, for us guys, 46XY? Does it have an extra chromosome 21? That's Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. Or an extra chromosome 13 or 18? Or is it missing a chromosome? That would be Turner syndrome. And so some of these are viable. We know individuals, obviously, who have Down syndrome, and I have patients who have Turner syndrome, and you know there are other ones that are pretty lethal. You know, an extra chromosome 16 is pretty much always lethal. So mm-hmm. again, the thought was, well, if you could screen these embryos, then you could avoid a miscarriage because you wouldn't put an embryo in that had trisomy 16, wouldn't result in a baby. And if you were really struggling with, you know, gosh, you know, having a Down syndrome baby, what would we do? Would we even contemplate ending that pregnancy? And the idea was, well, if I don't put the embryo in, it's not really ending the pregnancy because I was never pregnant. And for some individuals, they say, well, that's a different moral decision as opposed to ending a pregnancy. I feel like not putting the embryo back is a different decision, and I feel okay with that. I mean, on some level, of course, for the embryo, it's all the same outcome, right? Mm-hmm. You put it in or throw it out or, you know, end the pregnancy. So that was sort of the theory. And then along with that, you could identify certain genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis, which were caused by a single gene. And if you were trying to avoid that being passed on to the next generation because you had a child who had, you know, suffered from a really, really, really tough disease, that, you know, maybe this would be a way to, again, not end a pregnancy, but not even begin the pregnancy because you would choose not to put that embryo in. So that's sort of the rationale behind it. So the 6 to 8 cell embryos were damaged when you try to do this because you're just yanking one of those cells out and the other cells left behind are damaged, and you usually were freezing the embryos and then coming back later, although with the 6 to 8 cells, they were trying to do it fresh. So you would, you know, in the morning, you'd pull one of the cells out, you'd do a special test on the one cell and then make a decision, is that an embryo that we can transfer or not transfer? Then as we went to the PGT pre-implantation genetic testing 2.0 paradigm, they said, well, that doesn't seem to work so great, so let's wait till the embryo gets to the blastocyst stage. That was that hollow ball of cells where under the microscope you've got one group that are the inner cell mass that makes the baby, and the other set that is the part that makes the placenta. And so the idea was, well, we can't touch the part that makes the baby because that would definitely kill the developing baby, so that's not smart. So let's go and check the placenta part, you know, and basically take 3 to 5 cells from the part that will become the placenta and then analyze those cells so we won't touch the part that's the baby. And that makes some big assumptions. So that assumes that those cells are exactly the same as the cells that make the baby. Okay, and the problem is that may not be true, because if you're an embryo and you're growing and of the part that makes the baby, some of those cells turn out to have damage to their DNA, and you're saying, oh, well, let's put those cells in the trash bin. Mm. The trash bin is the placenta.
Mm.
So if you're biopsying the trash bin and you say, oh, there's a bunch of trash in the trash bin, well, let's just throw out the whole embryo. You may have made a mistake, because the reason that the bad cells are in the trash bin is because it's the trash bin.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't biopsy anything but the trash bin, because if you biopsy the part that makes the baby, you kill the embryo. Then there's no baby when you put it in. So this has been the big issue, is that biologically, this strategy may not be 100% effective for sure. And therefore, when you do genetic testing of these embryos, you have to be willing to understand that you are probably throwing out some normal embryos along with the abnormal ones.
Wow.
The question is, how many normal embryos are you willing to discard in your hope to, quote-unquote, refine the group of embryos that you have so they're all normal? Mm. And my answer was zero. So I'm not willing to throw out any. So I said, well, I can't offer it then, because I know this is going to happen. I mean, there's just really no way around it. And this has been shown in many studies. There are some studies that had done genetic testing of the embryos, then didn't even run the assay until after the children were born, and then found out that 10 to 15% of the embryos that they would have declared abnormal resulted in healthy babies being born.
Wow. So you're telling me if a mama comes in and they tell her, hey, you have these five embryos, they've got abnormal markers, we're going to throw them away. But if she decided to transfer them, they may have been a healthy, perfectly healthy baby.
That's right. And in fact, if you look at the bottom of the testing form from the genetic testing company, it says the results of this test should not be used for clinical decision making.
Oh, my goodness.
Then what is it being used for?
Exactly.
Oh,
they're
my
wiping
word.
Their hands of it. They're saying, it's not our fault.
So they're not held liable.
Right. So let me give you the extreme example of this. So I became disenchanted. I said, uh-oh, this means that I'm throwing out some embryos that are possibly okay because, you know, if you and it gets even more complicated. So, for example, when you're amplifying the DNA may not amplify correctly. So then you end up what's called abnormal copy numbers in your DNA amplification.
Wow.
So now you've got this mixed population. You're like, is this an embryo that has a completely normal genetic makeup or is it missing a single chromosome or an extra chromosome, or is it a mixture of some of the cells were normal and some of them were not, or is that all an artifact of the amplification of the DNA by PCR? So when you get an abnormal result, you don't even know, like, how abnormal is it?
Mm-hmm.
And so some embryos are falling into this middle ground called abnormal copy number, and some people call it mosaicism, but it may not even be mosaicism. Mosaicism means you checked six cells. Two of them had some weird abnormalities and four were normal. That's a mosaic embryo. But you see, what if the two that you think are abnormal is just the DNA didn't amplify completely with those two cells? They actually were okay or they were not okay. But now you got an intermediate test as a result of the process by which you're getting the genetic information. So it makes it even more complicated. So I was just sort of throwing up my hands and saying, well, this is just insane. I don't know what to tell patients. And I understand the desire to avoid suffering and to try to avoid, having a miscarriage and all these issues. But at what cost? At what cost are you willing to do that? And so in Fertility and Sterility Reports last January, a case report came out where an embryo was tested and found to have seven different genetic abnormalities. Missing chromosomes, extra chromosomes. And as open as I am to allow patients to transfer any embryo they have, including ones that were tested as abnormal, that would have given me pause. I would have said, are you sure you want to spend several thousand dollars to put this embryo in? I mean, it's got seven different genetic abnormalities. That sounds pretty bad. Well, this couple persevered, and they got their clinic to transfer that embryo. And that embryo that had seven genetic abnormalities resulted in a healthy baby boy with no genetic abnormalities.
Wow.
So then you say, oh, well, I mean, they must have just gotten pregnant on their own, and that's why. Except it was a lesbian couple using a sperm donor.
Wow.
So, they did not get pregnant on their own. So
what you're saying is that the cell has the potential to even self-correct after transfer. Is that correct?
Well, or something. In other words, we don't know because, again, if your biopsy is of the trash bin, the placenta, then everything you think you know about the embryo may not be correct, right? That the part that makes the baby, which you didn't touch, could be just fine.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a bunch of abnormal cells in the placenta because that's where the abnormal cells are supposed to be.
Right.
I mean, so again, you went to your trash bin, you say, wow, look at all the trash in the trash bin. That's terrible. Well, yeah, because that's not where you're eating your dinner, right? You go into your refrigerator, right? That's what you care about. You don't want to go to the trash bin. So again, this is where the whole process becomes problematic. So if you add to that the fact that the biopsy itself may be not so great for some embryos, that by doing the biopsy, the embryo that was normal is now not so normal anymore
because of the biopsy.
Mucked around with it to find out it was going to be normal. And now it's not normal. Now it won't implant.
Wow.
So this is the set of issues we find ourselves struggling with. And Robert Casper from Toronto wrote this beautiful editorial in the Journal of Assisted Reproduction and Genetics, and he entitled it PGTA, Houston, We Have a Problem.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a well-thought-of physician and scientist in Canada, and he had some just amazing studies. There was one study where in a randomized controlled study, if there was one embryo, one blastocyst embryo at the end of the IVF cycle, so they had gone through IVF, however many eggs they started with, one embryo available for testing or transfer. And the couples were randomized to either transfer the embryo or test the embryo, freeze the embryo, and if it's normal, come back and transfer the embryo. So they were randomized at that point. Decision made, there's one embryo, do we transfer it, or do we biopsy it, freeze it, test it, and then transfer it if it's normal? So the number of abnormal embryos in both groups should be the same, right? Mm-hmm. Because you're just randomizing them based upon the fact that people just had one embryo to either test or transfer. And in the group where they did the transfers, there was like 142 more babies born.
Wow.
So the only explanation is your testing was wrong, where the testing bumped off some of those embryos. Mm. That's a pretty powerful study. I mean, that is a problem. And that's why he entitled his paper, PGTA Houston, We Have a Problem.
Well, this is so important because, of course, on Hannah's Heart, we talk about the moral implications of genetic testing. And, you know, we believe that every human being is created the image of God, whether you have Turner syndrome or Down syndrome or any other syndrome. We believe that every life is sacred and worth protecting. But what you're talking about is from a scientific, so this is wonderful in dealing with unbelievers because you're saying from a scientific perspective, this technology, this process is not proven to necessarily help in live birth rates for IVF. It can have false positives. It can have false negatives. And it's just not reliable. Am I understanding that correctly?
Exactly right. It is exactly right. And so that's why even if you leave behind, as you said, the moral, spiritual, mm-hmm. ethical implications, you say from a straight scientific standpoint, the randomized controlled mm-hmm. studies performed, you know, using PGT have not shown a benefit. And then you've got studies like Dr. Casper points out saying, we've got a problem here. And you say, well, what the heck then? Why? Why are all these clinics pushing this? You know, why are patients signing up for it? And I guess there's sort of the cynical view, and then there's the kind of the non-cynical view. And I guess the non-cynical view is that the doctors believe that, you know, they're saving people heartache in terms of transferring embryos that, you know, would result in a miscarriage, and nobody wants to go through IVF and have a miscarriage, and this should help. And yet, the studies don't seem to show it helping very much because the miscarriage rate remains present even after PGT, somewhere 15% or higher. So it doesn't eliminate miscarriage. And so that's made people crazy. And then, you know, you've got this whole other issue of just, you know, the patient saying, well, if the embryos are abnormal, I don't want to spend my money on a transfer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd save my money so I can do another cycle, and this has been, you know, more efficient for me. And yet that doesn't seem to play out in some of the studies that Dr. Casper points out. So then that leaves you with the cynical view saying, well, why would these clinics do it? And say, well, we find ourselves in a arms race in a way between clinics saying, you know, our PGT is better than their PGT, and we do it in-house, and we don't send it out, and we charge you less, and it's become sort of an arms race where no one's willing to say the emperor has no clothes.
Wow.
And then a lot of this is not covered by insurance. So the really cynical view is, well, I practice in a mandated state where insurance companies all cover IVF, and I'm going to get paid $3,000 by my insurance company, by the insurance company for this patient. And you know what? If I tell her she has to do PGT and they have to pay me $5,000 cash, suddenly my IVF revenue stream just jumped up from $3,000 to $8,000 a cycle.
Wow.
And that's very cynical. And, you know, I don't want to say that that's the reason that all these things happen. And yet, you know, this is why countries like Great Britain, where they have mandated coverage for IVF and it's covered by the government, have eliminated PGT and say, we will not pay for this. This is untested.
The science is not there. This is what Christians are accused of being on the wrong side of science. But come on, clinics.
Right. The science is not there.
Wow. Well, we just have a moment left, but I wanted you to quickly address, let's say someone came into your clinic and they have had multiple miscarriages. Maybe they've had some genetic problems, and they're saying, well, what can be done for us if we don't want to do PGTA testing? Is there anything that can help us? Do you have any advice?
Well, it's so hard to go through multiple miscarriages, you know, and some of the patients come to the conclusion that maybe we can just never make a genetically normal embryo, and they decide that we are going to take a different path and we're going to pursue embryo adoption or donor egg or donor sperm, or just keep trying and you know, be a little bit more proactive. But it is difficult, and I am certainly very sympathetic. It's very hard to go through multiple pregnancy losses.
But Dr. Gordon, our time is not kind to anyone. That's our closing music. But I did want to mention that you all work with the National Embryo Donation Center. So if couples do choose to go that route, you need to check out the NEDC because they're incredible. Dr. Gordon, thank you so much for shedding light on a topic that people really do not know enough about.
And just very quickly, if I would have been given the chance with John Micah to terminate that pregnancy, I wouldn't have been able to do it, because his little life, even though he was only 26 weeks, was worth going through hardship for.
That's right.
Amen.
That's right.